So I titled this presentation "The Supply Chain Factor" because of the description that the folks gave me that they wanted me to talk about. And it really is apropos in today's environment because most of our healthcare systems across the country now have 30 to 40% of their IT environment somewhere else other than in the four walls of their institution, which means that your risk literally extends beyond whatever your health system is, your health plan is, or whoever it is, wherever your physical location is. And we are connected to so many more people, and we are sharing data with so many more folks. And unfortunately, that also accounts for about 40, 45% of the breaches that we have today as well. It's not the guys that own the data, it's the guy that's got the data that belongs to somebody else that's supposed to be doing something responsible with it. Kind of like Equifax, right? So, I mean, when you think about that, and, you know, it was really funny when that came out at the beginning of the week. Obviously, I was inundated with reporters wanting to know my opinion. I was like, you got to be kidding me. There's no, how do you have an opinion on 143 million records lost? And for something as simple as probably what turns out to be bad practices, lack of patching, poor password management, et cetera. Basically not doing the things that we know that we need to do day to day to protect our environments and to protect the data that we've been entrusted with. But the other bigger question that's starting to bubble up now, and it's bubbling up in the class action lawsuits that are beginning to pile up and in the dialogue in Washington, is this whole story of data aggregators. Data aggregators have a target on their backs today. Anybody who collects data from multiple sources, multiple business entities, multiple hospitals, et cetera, and manages that data for them for some reason or another, has a huge target on their backs right now. And that target is going to get more and more focused as they go through this evaluation of this whole Equifax thing, because it's just another example of how some organization who collects a lot of data from a lot of different organizations has then all of a sudden compromised literally thousands of organizations and millions of people, all in one breach, right? You can't even put a number on it. And I think the last number that I saw with respect to the class action lawsuits is already up to $70 billion. I don't even know how they're gonna survive after this, but they will. Hopefully, the good thing is the CEO of Equifax didn't come out the next day like the CEO of Anthem did and say, don't worry about it, shareholders, we got enough money in the bank to cover this. And what he did was he told everybody he's overcharging you for insurance, right? And they can afford to make this kind of a mistake, and it's no big deal. But these kinds of mistakes are happening every minute of every day. While we're sitting here today, I guarantee you some health system somewhere is having an incident right now. Our company right now deals with about 5 incidents a week across the country. And these are just folks. We deal with about 850 hospitals right now across the country. And we have about 5 incidents a week where somebody is having something happening in their environment that is causing them some form of pain. Most of the time today, it's disruption. And when you look at this whole timeline, this whole chain of events that's occurring is occurring for a very, very simple reason. We have a convergence of many different things. One of the first things we had back in 2009 was what? What happened in 2009? We decided to automate or to digitize all of our patient information and force people to put it into EHRs. Now that's a good thing, right? It has all the pluses around EHR and being able to share data, et cetera, et cetera. But it also had the downside of amplifying the cyber risk that's associated with it, because all of a sudden now, information that used to be in those colored files when I started in this industry, right, with all the different colors of tape on them that the little old ladies were protecting at the door of the HIM room that you couldn't get. And the only way you could get all that information from a hospital was if you backed up a semi truck and broke in physically and stole all those files. I don't have to do that now. All I have to do is wait for somebody to make a mistake in how they configure something, make a mistake in whether or not they patch something on time, or just have a zero-day attack out there that we don't even know about yet, And I get into the system, and if we're not doing the things that we're supposed to be doing, out goes the data, and it goes out in literally seconds, as opposed to the time it would take me to steal it physically. But that's where we're at. We've gone from theft to hacking to now disruption. And that's probably the biggest concern that we have today, is that the attacks that we're seeing today, other than things like Equifax, which was clearly a data grab, we're now seeing attacks that are focused just on disruption. And the next phase of this, we believe, is corruption, which is something we haven't seen yet, but we believe that that's what's going to happen next, which is hackers beginning to come in and corrupt data. Now think about that for a second. Think about the time when you cannot trust your data, or you cannot trust the information that's in that EHR because somebody has corrupted it. And the clean, just the cleanup alone you'd have to do to go through all those millions of records to try to figure out what's been changed and what hasn't. It's a big issue. It's also costing our industry, and all industries for that matter, a lot of money. There's an enormous cost that's associated with what we're dealing with today, and it's just going to get worse. When you look at healthcare in general, when you talk about a breach, and I'm going to talk about one in particular that just happened about a month ago in a little bit, there are multiple things that happen when there's a breach. And some of these costs don't occur until months down the road. In some cases, they don't even occur until years down the road. In fact, the tail we are now figuring out on breaches in terms of figuring out the total cost of a breach or the total impact of a breach can be as long as 20 years. From the time of your incident. So when you think you've cleaned it up, you may have cleaned it up from an IT perspective, but you haven't cleaned it up from a business perspective or a risk to the patients themselves. And again, it's this convergence issue. In 2009, we automated all this stuff. The threat has escalated every year since 2009, and has not only escalated in terms of its broadness, but in terms of its sophistication, and in terms of its frequency. We are now, when you take ransomware attacks alone, how many folks heard of a ransomware attack 3 years ago? We didn't hardly hear about them, right? Ransomware has been around, believe it or not, since the 1980s, believe it or not. The first ransomware attack was a 5.5-inch floppy disk. That's right. It wasn't successful. It wasn't until a decade later that two scientists took that ransomware attack, analyzed it, and figured out why it failed and what you'd have to do to make it successful, and then they published their results. And lo and behold, we had the birth of the new ransomware, right? Because what they figured out in that first attack was that they had actually embedded the decryption code in the actual attack itself. So if you had that and you could take it apart and reverse engineer it, you could decrypt the data yourself. And so that's why that first one didn't work. They figured out that if you used asynchronous encryption and you had a public and a private key, all of a sudden somebody didn't have that other key, they couldn't decrypt the data. Hence, we have the more modern type of attack. But they've actually evolved even further than that, to the point now where they go in and not only just encrypt the data, they go in and destroy the data that's there after they've made a copy of it and send you your nice ransom note, so that now the data that you think you're going to restore is not there to restore unless you have a copy of your data that is not on your system. And what's really ironic about this, if you've been in this game long enough, you know that 10 years ago, we began to tell institutions, stop putting backup data on tapes and drives that you put in cardboard boxes and you store in these rooms, because they fall out of the back of trucks, they get lost, they get damaged, they get stolen. Let's go to asynchronous backup, where we have a primary data center and a backup data center, and we back up our data within seconds of creating it over here in the production environment. And then when we have an issue over here, we just fail over to our second site and we have our data and we're ready to go. The problem with that is that those are connected. And so when the ransomware comes in, it doesn't just get to the primary data in the production environment, it gets to the backup data in the secondary site. And so now all of a sudden we're back to square one again, where we're saying, well, we're going to actually have a copy of our data that's on some system or on some format that's not connected to our environment at all, so that when the incident happens, we actually have a good copy of our data to back up from. We see every form of attack that's out there today in healthcare. You look at malware, we have almost a half a billion new malware a year that comes out from the threat community. Think about that for a second. The IT guys in this room, I know, understand what I'm talking about because they see the thousands and thousands of hits that are in their firewall logs and in their IDS logs and the other systems that they have on their environment watching this stuff, and it is a daily onslaught. It's what it is. It's just happening every second of the day. Most of our systems today, the antiquated systems of the past, can't keep up with it, which is why most organizations today have actually begun to invest in advanced malware solutions, next generation firewalls, et cetera, as well as 24/7 monitoring, because quite frankly, you can't keep up with it manually anymore. It's just that simple. And anybody trying to keep up with it that way is going to find themselves behind. Cyber espionage. How many people remember the attacks against Anthem and the Blues, right? Shortly after the attacks against Anthem and the Blues, who did we have attacked in the government? OPM. Everybody know who OPM is? The Office of Personnel Management, right? They handle all of the background investigations for all of the federal employees that work in most of the agencies and in services across the government, right? So guys like myself and my wife, who was a federal agent, both of us, our backgrounds were in there. Everything about us from our 16th birthday was in that database. All of our credit history, all of our family history, every location we'd ever lived in. So all the times that I served as an intelligence officer overseas, when I wasn't actually an intelligence officer, whoever got that database now knows that I was an intelligence officer, right? That's how sensitive that OPM database was that those people got their hands on, which is one of the reasons why we still haven't seen the damage assessment come out from that breach, because they have no way of quantifying what that damage is. Because all of us who worked for years and years, and I did for more than 20 years in the federal government as an intel guy, all of that history is now laid to bear with whoever stole that database, which we now know was the Chinese. The Chinese also stole the Anthem databases. Why do you steal 80 million records? Or 11 million records? Why do you steal that kind of information? You could be stealing it to put it on the black market to resell it, but that's not why nation-state actors steal this information. They steal it because since the beginning of time, we've always collected against our adversaries, and we've always collected against our allies. Every country in the world collects information against every other country in the world. And those databases are a treasure trove of information. And if you wonder why healthcare information is so important, we actually monitor the health of other nations. What are their people dying of? What is the average age when they expire? What is the number one disease that's affecting that organization or regionally? We do this for many reasons. Operationally, so when guys like me who used to be a Marine going into certain places, we want to know what I might be exposed to so they know which shots to give me before they send me there. If we don't track that stuff, if we don't pay attention to what's going on in the world with respect to diseases and et cetera, then we'll never know that, okay? Other countries do the same thing. And there are other reasons for this. But this is a big deal, and it's happening in our sector. Targeted attacks. Targeted attacks like the Equifax attack was absolutely a targeted attack. Somebody set out to steal that data from them. We have this all the time. The attack against UCLA was a targeted attack when they stole those records from UCLA. We have these attacks on a regular basis. And these are the most insidious ones because these are usually the guys that are the most sophisticated and they're the most deliberate and they're the most patient, meaning they'll find a way in, they'll get into the environment, and they will typically sit there for anywhere from 6 to 12 months doing nothing but reconnaissance inside your network. Understanding how you communicate, understanding what systems you have deployed, putting together their detailed plan for how they're actually going to exploit your environment when they get around to doing it. and they're usually very effective as a result. Extortion. How many of you have small children? How many of you monitor what they do on a computer? If you don't, please do. Extortion today is not just happening in business. The biggest, the fastest rising form of extortion today, believe it or not, is exploitation of children, exploitation of minors. People getting on the internet, getting these children into chat rooms, getting them into spaces where they can see them on a camera, getting them to trust them and getting them to do something that they shouldn't, and then turning around and extorting the parents. You do not want that call or that email. So make sure you're paying attention to what your children are doing on the net, and make sure that you are educating them that the people that they talk to on the web are not necessarily who they think they're talking to, especially if it's somebody on a gaming console. Every gaming console we have out there so far has been compromised. And that's something we need to understand. But this happens in healthcare way too frequently now. We have about 24 ransomware attacks a week in healthcare right now, somewhere in the country. Somewhere right now, as we're sitting here, they're having a ransomware attack where they're being extorted for money in some form or another. This is becoming the new problem that we all need to really pay attention to, and that is the device issue. And this includes medical devices, this includes all kinds of smart devices, it includes environmental systems that we have in our environment, it includes the things that you bring into the environment from a comfort perspective. I'll give you an example. One of the presentations that my cyber guys do every once in a while is we give presentations where we demonstrate how easy it is to hack an organization through an IoT device. And a lot of times we use something as simple as a coffee pot. How many folks have seen the coffee pots, the smart coffee pots that you can actually communicate with from your phone? Right? You can be driving into work and you can tell it, you can put the stuff in the day before or night before. You can be driving in from work and you can turn it on remotely, wirelessly, from your phone and tell it to start brewing the coffee. So that by the time you get to the office, it's nice and warm and it's ready. Right? That coffee pot is probably not very secure. And depending on how you connected it to your network, now your network is probably not very secure. And believe it or not, we have actually run attacks where we have gone from a simple coffee pot and connected to a network and been able to take control of the network. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I want to hear it. So I have a 2016 Audi Q5, doesn't matter. Anyway, so one day I'm at work, and my work phone rings, and I pick it up, and okay, Cocktails Plans, this is Susan, and it was the service for Audi. And he said his name, my name's Jay, calling from Audi service. I want you to know that the blinker in your passenger mirror is out. This is a scam, right? Yeah, no. No, you own this car, blah, blah, blah. It's actually a lease. But anyway, I said, well, first of all, I didn't know I had a blinker in my rearview mirror, in my mirror on the outside. That's interesting. And second, how do you know it's out? My car called them through Bluetooth and told them, and then they called me. They've done that, and then they've also told me I had a low tire. You need to come in. We'll look at your tire. And there was a nail.
These are all
it.
Cool things, right?
I thought so too. But you know, but what if somebody gets that and takes away my brakes?
Exactly. Then turn it over on the flip side and take somebody like me that you used to collect data for information for a living. And I look at that and I say, what a wonderful opportunity!
Exactly.
I can now track her. I can know where she's at all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so did you have something, or you just took the mic?
That, and then because I work in IT, we all know we have defects. And, you know, now that my car is running on software, runs into a defect that has an open port, and they can turn it off at a stoplight. It's crazy.
Yes. In fact, this year at DEF CON, they demonstrated how to hack cars and tell them to do other things. Okay. Bottom line is these devices which there are literally billions of, and by 2021, we expect that there will be more than 200 billion IoT devices connected to our environments. Think about your home. How many of you have a smart TV, have a Samsung TV? Okay. Do you have a firewall between your network and your cable provider? If you don't, I can take that TV and I can watch you while you're watching your favorite show. And you'll never know it. I see some of the looks around here. Please don't do anything in front of your TV you don't want your children to see. But think about that. I mean, you need to understand that all of these devices, your phone can be turned into a receiver. I can get close enough to your phone with a device, and if it's not protected properly, I can actually download software on your device, your phone, that will allow me to activate your phone without you knowing it, because it won't turn the light on, it won't power, it won't look like it's doing anything, but then I can sit there and listen to whatever your conversation is.
I don't know if this has been validated, you could probably help, but there have been times where friends, family, even myself have been talking about a specific conversational topic, and lo and behold, on Facebook, that ad appears. It means your phone is listening to you. So we're not paranoid, we're just convinced.
Or your microphone and your computer is listening to you. All right. I mean, these are all things, you know, the little windows you see that people have that they put on their computer to cover up that camera, that the camera that's on your computer, get one of those. Because I can actually turn your camera on and watch you, and that little green light that's supposed to come on, I can do it without turning the green light on. So you never know that I'm watching. Okay? All of this smart technology that provides all of this comfort and convenience and all these great things also has a dark side associated with it. And you need to understand that. Every time we create a new technology, a new software system, a new program, anything, the hacker community is reverse engineering that device, that software, that tool, that whatever, trying to figure out how they can get it to do something that it wasn't intended to do. That's how this works. And the point is that that's their job every day. You know, they're like the day traders on the market. They're sitting at home in their underwear doing this stuff. And think about it. How much does the average ransomware attack pay off? Do you know? Does anybody know? $17,000. That's the average right now. What is the average percent of U.S. hospital that pays the ransom? Do you know that number? 64%. That just absolutely kills guys like me, and it kills the feds and the law enforcement. Because every time you pay, what do? You incent them to do it more. And healthcare is a wonderful target right now for that community. Because they got a 60% chance that somebody's going to pay them when they launch that attack. I can launch hundreds of those attacks from my bedroom at night or my living room at night before I go to bed, and wait for the payoffs in the next few days. And if each one of them is $17,000 to $20,000, how many of those do I have to launch before I start making some decent money? How hard do you work for $17,000? Okay? Think about it for a second. It's an industry that pays. Healthcare is also a critical infrastructure. And if you haven't, there are 16 critical infrastructures. And when I was in the federal government, at the end before I retired, I sat on the committee that managed the security of the 16 critical infrastructures across our country. And the reason we did that was because if, God forbid, our country ever found itself in a natural disaster or in a wartime where we had to reconstitute and rebuild our country and recover, we needed to know where those things were and what we were going to have to do to be able to do that. So there's things like communications, banking, healthcare, energy, etc. Healthcare is a critical infrastructure of this country. Healthcare is also a huge data aggregator for information about the health and welfare of this nation, to include all of its people, to include people in sensitive positions, to include people in political positions, to include people in financial power positions, etc. If I attack the infrastructure, when you think of the Boston Children's attack a few years back, Boston Children's was the target. Do you realize that, you never hear about this, but do you realize that 5 other hospitals were taken down when Boston Children's was taken down? And the reason they were was because they were all on the same service provider, because the attacker took out the service provider to take down Boston Children's. The problem is, when they did that, they took down everybody else who was relying on that service provider. You don't have to be the intended target. Who was the intended target of WannaCry? Anybody know? Ukraine. Who was the intended target of NotPetya? Ukraine. Who was attacking them? Come on, you know the answer to this one. Who doesn't like the Ukraine? Russia, right? Mr. Putin doesn't like the Ukraine at all. He's not happy with those folks. He would like for them to be back part of the evil empire. Who was affected by WannaCry and NotPetya? The world. The world, right? Everybody who was connected to the World Wide Web, who had not fixed those vulnerabilities that were associated with those attacks, were affected. Because when they launched it, there was no way to launch it and to absolutely guarantee that it was just going to affect the people that they were targeting. Because what are those people connected to? Other people. And what are those people connected to? Other people. And who are you connected to? Some of those other people. And that's kind of, and that's how that happens, and that's how that works. Do you realize that there are 10 URLs that if you shut those down, you will eliminate 95% of the malware that potentially could affect your organization? Because that's where the majority of it comes from. Most health organizations have a hard time doing that, though. How many hospitals in America need to talk directly to Russia or to sites in Russia? Not everybody, but the ones that do typically have to talk to somebody specifically in Russia. So you shut off .ru so that anything from Russia can't come across the transom, and then you whitelist the people in Russia that are legitimate that you need to speak to. And now all of a sudden, that's the only traffic that comes across. Some things as simple as that sometimes will save us. Are we ready? How many folks know what Black Hat and DEF CON are? Okay, Black Hat and DEF CON, for the rest of you, is where the hackers get together and talk about all the great ways to make your lives more difficult, all right? Make all of our lives more difficult. One of the questions that they got asked before they arrived there was how many of them felt that we were ready to respond to an attack on U.S. critical infrastructure. 60% said we're not ready. 60% said we're not ready, right? That's not a surprise to me. After the Ukrainian attacks a few years ago, there was an organization in America that actually, like the RAND Group, that actually did a strategic study of all of our critical infrastructure and how vulnerable it was, which we used to do all the time in the government. We used to do threat assessments all the time, but they were classified and we didn't publish them, not to the general public. But these knuckleheads wrote this thing, identified the 26 critical sites in America that if you attacked, you could take out our infrastructure, and then they published it. So everybody in the world now has that information. So is your supply chain secure? How many people think that their supply chain is secure? Every one of these incidents that you see listed here, and this is just a sample, are things that have happened that with a third party that have affected the primary organization, whether it was a health plan, whether it was a health system, et cetera. Everything from printers that somebody had. How many of you have a contract with somebody who manages your printers for you? Is IT even involved in that contract? Sometimes they are. A lot of times they're not. Most healthcare organizations' supply chain manages that. And all they care about is how much money they save. not how well those printers are maintained. In fact, a lot of times when we go in and do assessments of them, we find that the patching on those systems is anywhere from 5 to 6 years old, meaning in most cases they haven't been patched since the day they were taken out of the box and plugged into the network. And they are a problem, right? There are all kinds of issues here. The GitHub one, the 450,000 medical records exposed. This is a really, really cool one. And when I was talking to the compliance officer at this organization, I was actually up speaking at a conference in Boston, and she asked me if I could come by her office the next day, and I did, and as she started telling me this story, she started crying. So I said, okay, let's take a moment. I said, because obviously whatever you're about to tell me is not good. I said, so why don't you collect yourself? And I said, and then go bring me an NDA. Because I said, whatever you tell me, you probably should tell me under NDA. And she did, and I signed it. And then she told me how they had an engineer. They were working a CRM. Everybody understand what a CRM is, right? The marketing folks use it a lot. Sales uses it a lot. Now the health systems use it in the foundations, and even believe it or not, we're using CRMs now integrated with EHRs to track patients' activity. Woo! So what they're doing, this company was doing, was they were taking classic CRMs and modifying them for health purposes, for hospitals. And they had entered into an agreement with a large health system on the East Coast that had asked them to create one of these for them. And this particular health system, which will go unnamed, of course, had decided that they couldn't be bothered to produce test data. They just wanted to give them real data because they were in a hurry to get this done. So the health system gave them 450,000 records as a test database. Now, I don't know where that number came from or why they picked it, but I think they could have picked something smaller. But they didn't. They gave these knuckleheads 450,000 real patient records to use as their test base for their CRM that they were building for them. The engineer who was working on the project was one of these guys who didn't like a lot of structure. So he decided he didn't want to work at work, he wanted to work at home. So he decided to take one of the company's laptops, move the CRM that he was working on onto that laptop, and move the database, the patient database, onto that laptop. Now, the good news is all of their laptops were encrypted, so so far, so good. But when he got home, he decided that working on a laptop really wasn't convenient, so he decided to transfer it all to his home computer because he had a nice big screen and it was so much easier to work on that. So now we got this database on this laptop that the organization doesn't know about, and now we've got this database on this home computer that the organization doesn't know about. But then he decided that these 450,000 records were taking up way too much of his storage, so he goes to GitHub and he buys space on GitHub, personal space on GitHub, unprotected space on GitHub, and he puts it out on GitHub. Now, does anybody understand what GitHub does when you give them data in order to ensure that your data is there and backed up? They replicate it. So now GitHub made 3 copies of that database and put it on in 3 different locations. So now how many copies of this database do I have? I have 5 that the organization doesn't know about and that the hospital doesn't know about and that this individual is controlling. And then what do you think he does next? He decides he just doesn't want to work anymore, so he comes in, hands them the laptop, and says, I'm done. It was in the process of handing in the laptop, when they looked at his laptop, that they discovered all of this information on his laptop, that they then asked him the questions, which then discovered where else this data was, and they realized, we have a problem. Now, there's a good side to this story. The health organization, who was in a hurry to get them to do it so fast, it made the mistake of giving them live data in the first place because it was convenient to do that as opposed to doing the smart thing, also had a really crappy BAA and a really bad contract. And there was nothing in the contract that talked about security, and there was nothing in the BAA that limited the organization's ability to do this as well. And there was nothing in the BAA that told the vendor that they had to report to them their breach any sooner than the federal guidelines. Now, that's a mistake, right? Because if your vendor has the breach, you're still responsible for all the notifications. Now, they don't have to notify you until the 59th day. And how many days do you have left to make all the notifications? One, right? Because the clock doesn't change just because you didn't pay attention to that or have the right agreements in place. So literally what ended up happening here was the vendor reported the breach to the health provider, but because there was no indemnification language either in their contract, which I was just floored by this when this situation all occurred. I told him, look, the good news is you can tell the provider about the breach and not have to worry about it because there's nothing in here for them to come back at you on. And I said, unless OCR decides to come after you, I said, you're really kind of sort of off scot-free here, and the health provider is going to be left holding the bag. And that's exactly what happened. All this stuff is important. You never know what those third parties are doing with your assets. This hospital down here is a hospital, believe it or not, in Houston. And this hospital had an outside vendor who installed two Citrix servers in their data center. When they installed those two Citrix servers in the data center and they were managing those two servers for the hospital, they left a back door into both those servers and they left the default password on one of them. A hacker finally found it, found the server, got on it, was able to compromise the server, was patient enough to wait until the admin logged into that server the next time around with his admin credentials and grabbed those network credentials, those admin credentials, then used those to do surveillance of that organization for the next 6 months before they launched their ransomware attack. And in that 6 months, they discovered that the organization was not really monitoring their logs, because what they did was they methodically began to disable functionality on systems and watched what the organization did in response. The forensics on this was so fantastic. Now, I know you're not excited about this, but let me tell you, from our world, this was like pure science. These guys went in, disabled a couple of things, waited 2 weeks, nothing happened. Disabled a couple more things, waited 2 weeks, nothing happened. Got a little braver, started disabling security functions, nothing happened. Got a little braver, started literally deinstalling security agents on systems. Nothing happened. And the minute they figured that out, they went to town. And in less than 2 hours, they took down almost the entire hospital server environment because they were able to deploy their ransomware very quickly because nobody was watching and there was nothing stopping them. This particular attack here happened, like I said, just about a month ago, and it's a hospital out in California, and it's not a large hospital, so it was even more disruptive. And the cost there that said has already exceeded $500,000, that was 2 weeks ago. It's now exceeded well over $1 million in terms of the cost, just the cost of responding to the incident itself and recovering the environment. But the reason this one was so bad was in this particular case, they had an individual who worked for a company who was providing network admin support for them. And again, it's a very smart network guy who was doing this remotely, who knew knew his way around the network, who had the administrative level privileges to essentially set himself up any way he wanted if nobody was watching, which is exactly what was going on. And this guy was doing work from home on their network, on their core systems, without a VPN, just connecting. He had also, in order to make his life more convenient, he had also installed a program on all of their servers that allowed him to remotely deploy software as a program. So in other words, he could launch it at night before he went to bed, get up in the morning, and see how many of the servers had updated with whatever it was that he was updating them with. And he could basically go on and do whatever else he was doing and just do it, would let the system run it. The hacker who compromised his environment compromised his credentials, then followed him into the network, realized what he had done, took control of the network, locked this guy out, locked all the rest of the hospital folks out, and then went through and literally using the software that this guy had deployed without their knowledge and deployed ransomware on all of their servers, and in less than 30 minutes infected every one of them. It started at 2 o'clock in the morning. At 4 o'clock in the morning, we got a phone call at our help desk that said, we're in trouble, our servers are dropping like flies. We said, first thing we did was we said, take all your critical systems offline, connect them from the network immediately. Because we knew they didn't have the people or the wherewithal to be able to track it down fast enough to stop it from hitting something that was really sensitive. The good news is we actually saved their EHR and most of their critical systems, but they lost almost their entire environment. When we went in and started working on trying to help them with this, we found out that they too had not been keeping up with patching, had not been doing good job of doing configuration management. They had backed up their data, so we had a good copy of their data, but they hadn't backed up any of their system configurations. Now, who does that? But they hadn't. They didn't have any of that stuff documented, and they didn't have any of it backed up. So what that meant was that literally we had to rebuild that environment from the bare metal up, and we had to troubleshoot every single application as we reinitiated it to include all of the interconnections and interoperability between that one and others. And it has taken forever to get them back up and running. Now, what we did do in the meantime was we actually drop shipped other equipment in and we set up another makeshift network from another ISP to get their EHR and their critical systems back up and running. The hospital actually never stopped operating. We were able to get, fortunately this happened on a Thursday, and we were able to get the network back up by Friday at noon. So that the hospital, in terms of operations, never they knew it, but because the workstations weren't working, and they were having to use these new ones. But the point was is that they were able to take care of all their patients. They didn't have to turn anybody away. They didn't have to cancel procedures. They were able to get things done. But it's been enormously expensive for them. We had literally about 30 people on site between vendors, because we had to bring the vendors in too, because a lot of these systems, we didn't know what the issues were between systems, so we had to bring the vendors in as well to help us troubleshoot these things as we began to try to restructure. This hospital probably spent somewhere in the neighborhood of around $250,000 a year on security. They've spent over $2 million on this one incident already, and they're not done yet. And this is a California hospital, so the minute they notified the California authorities, immediately right after that, they began to start getting the press, and they began to start getting people talking about a class action lawsuit, which is certainly something they can't afford. And they still have their federal notification to make, which will come here shortly. It is incredibly costly when these things happen. And every bit of this could have been avoided by simple good practices in how we manage the environment. So when we think about those third parties that are out there, we need to right up front define the requirements for that relationship. When we think about a new vendor, we think about a new service, we think about a new piece of software, we think about especially somebody who's going to touch our data or have access to our data or have our data for some purpose, we need to go through this list of things and determine what exactly do they need. And we need to think about how much information we let them have. How much do they need in order to do whatever it is they're doing? All too often, it is way too convenient to just give them access to the database as opposed to trying to figure out the information that they need for whatever their purpose is. We need to rethink that in a lot of ways. We need to identify the security requirements, like how do you connect to my network? How do I monitor you? Because I need to monitor you now. I need to treat you like everybody else that's in my environment. We need to understand any what the SLAs are going to be with respect to privacy and security. And we need to make sure that we embed this in our RFPs, RFIs, et cetera, so that we start weeding out the people who are bidding for things that aren't going to be able to do this in the first place, right? Ask them those security questions up front. When we get into the contract process, we need to make sure that we tailor it to the contract, because what happens when you have a breach is both the insurance people, the lawyers, and the government folks that are investigating, they all start with what's in the contract. And when the contract is broad in language, guess what? The investigation is broad in scope, and the loopholes that insurance and others can take advantage of are numerous. The more narrow that contract is with respect to what a vendor can and can't do, or should or shouldn't do, or what they should or shouldn't have access to, it's more clear when they step over the line or when they violate it, and it's easier to enforce. You should request documentation from them. What have they done? If they're a vendor that is working in healthcare today, I guarantee you somebody out there, some system out there, has asked them to perform a risk assessment. Ask them for it. Ask them for a copy of it, or ask them for an attestation that they've done it, and who did it, and when they did it, and what came out of it. Make sure that there's proof of training. All too often, one of the first things the government always looks at when they investigate is, were the individuals involved in the breach trained properly? And what we find in most cases is that they were not. They were just thrown on the job very quickly, and that's especially true when we talk about third parties. If it's a big enough-ish contract, if you've outsourced your EHR to somebody, or you've outsourced your primary system to somebody that's core to your business, it may be worthwhile to go take a look at where they're putting this information. Make sure you have language in your contract as well as to where that information can physically reside, so that when they change their business model, or when they're acquired by somebody who is an Indian company, for instance, that they can't just take their database and ship it overseas without you knowing about it, or move that database somewhere else without your permission, or take your information out of their data center and put it in a cloud without you understanding what that means and where that cloud is. But this happens all the time. We find health systems all the time, health plans, where they have information that they've given to a vendor, and they think they know where that data is, and only to find out that when they get the notification that there's a breach, that information was somewhere that they never knew it went to because of some other tertiary relationship. Make sure things are defined clearly in the contract, as I said. Material changes, subcontractors. Make sure you know if they've got subcontractors and consultants working for them. Make sure you understand what minimal necessary is for the contract and that they do too. How do we communicate? What requirements do you have around storage and processing? And a big one, incident response. I can't tell you how many organizations have had an incident only to be in the middle of the investigation and find out they get no support from the vendor. And the reason for that is because there's nothing in their BAA or nothing in their contract that requires it, and they've never talked to the organization about it. You need to make sure that anybody that you have given critical information to understands what your expectations are in the event that there's a breach in their environment, how soon you want to be notified of it, how you want them to work with you with respect to the investigation, what information you want them to provide to you, etc. If you don't ask for it, I guarantee you, you won't get it. Let me go back. And contingency operations. How many folks were familiar with the Nuance situation with NotPetya? How many folks knew folks that were affected by that? Just about everybody, right? There are a lot of organizations today that are literally casting Nuance out as we speak and looking at alternative solutions because they are very, very unhappy about that situation, as well they should be. The problem is that when you have a critical operation or a critical service or activity that's reliant on a third party, you better understand what that third party's contingency plans are for recovering their own operation. How many people remember the Mirai attack at the end of 2016, which was an IoT attack, which attacked the Dyn servers? Dyn servers went down. What went down with the Dyn servers? Anybody know? Two different SaaS-based EHR systems. We had literally hundreds of hospitals and physician practices across the country who lost their EHR because of that Dyn attack. Because the organizations that were providing those services did not have redundancy in their plan, contingency plans, for what they would do if they lost their primary ISP. If you are a critical data center that is supporting multiple entities, it is almost criminal not to have a redundancy plan that is based on redundant power sources from different grids, redundant ISPs from different parts of the country, et cetera, et cetera. Because something can always happen, and you need to be able to fail over to support your clients. We literally, like I said, had hundreds of hospitals that lost, and those organizations, many of them have actually started looking for new EHRs as a result. Maintenance. Once we're in the contract, we need to pay attention to it, communicate with those folks on a periodic basis. In some cases, actually test those contingency plans and operations to make sure that we know they're real. Breach notification, I talked about, but make sure it's very detailed in what we tell them that we want from them. And this is real important because a lot of times we don't do it. Indemnification is something that all of us vendors hate. But you know what? If you're going to take somebody's data and hold it for them and it's critical to their business, you need to understand that there's probably going to be some form of accountability associated with that to be in that space. Oh, the notifications to public, you probably think that that's a crazy one. We've literally had vendors who have had breaches who have notified the public ahead of the covered entity. That is a real embarrassing situation when your patients get the letter from somebody else and you haven't told them yet. Contract termination, think about termination. What happens? Think about these big data aggregators and a lot of these breaches. When you think of Anthem, for instance, of those 80 million records, how many of those records were active? About 60-something percent, right? Which means they still had information on people they were no longer covering. Why? Why? It's real simple. Because nobody's checking and nobody's telling them to get rid of it. Make sure in your contract it clearly states what your expectations are at the end of the contract if somebody has your patient data or your client's patient data or what have you. Right? All right, what are some of the key takeaways? Executives absolutely need to recognize that this is a business issue. It is not an IT issue. And thank God for the last 2 years, I've probably spoken to more boards in healthcare systems across the country than I ever have in the previous 20 years working in healthcare. And a lot of it's because of these breaches, of course, but the fact of the matter is they need to talk about it. I actually am a director on a publicly traded board, and as such, I'm a member of what's called the National Association of Corporate Directors. Every month, that publication sends me a magazine that talks about responsibilities of corporate directors because, of course, we have fiduciary responsibility, which will actually get your attention. And every month, there's an article in that magazine that talks about cybersecurity now and about how directors need to pay attention to it because if you don't do the things that we need to do to protect organizations properly, guess what? Directors and executives, et cetera, officers of the company can be held responsible. But more importantly than that, the organization needs their involvement. This is a real big one, and this gets to the aggregator issue again. If you don't need it, if you aren't supposed to have it, don't hold it. Organizations that get involved in research, organizations that get involved in thinking about secondary uses for data, typically try to hold on to data far longer than they should. You need to understand that the longer you hold on to information and the greater the amount of information you hold on to, the greater amount of risk and liability you have. It's just that simple, right? We need that executive commitment in terms of the program. When I was the director of security at the agency, one of the nice things about being in the Department of Defense and in the intelligence community was that from everybody from the general on down was committed to protecting our information and our information systems. And it was absolutely clear to everybody in the organization that that edict came from the highest levels of the organization. And in fact, everybody in the organization had a requirement in their appraisal process that said, if you have a security violation or just a security incident, you are not eligible for promotion or bonus for that year. Think about that for a second. Why do we do that in the intelligence community? Because when we screw up, people die. It's just that simple. You hear that line on TV and you probably go, oh, that's bullshit. It's not. It really is true. Anybody know a guy named Aldrich Ames? Aldrich Ames was a senior CIA officer who was caught as a spy in 2003. Yeah, 2003. Aldrich had been the field chief in Frankfurt his last 3 years before he came back to Washington before he was discovered. Aldrich had been spying for the Russians for 20 years before we caught him. When we caught Aldrich, 127 people around the globe died in less than 24 hours. Because everybody that the Russians knew about that had been compromised was taken out. So when you hear that line, there's some actual truth to it. Now, we're not going to kill people when we screw up in healthcare, hopefully, but we might, right? And we need to start thinking about it. I heard the other day somebody said we need to start treating, how many technical guys we got in the room? Just a few? I heard the other day somebody say we need to start treating our patch list like one of our critical elements on our P&L. Meaning, if we don't keep up with it, it's going to affect the business. And in fact, it is affecting the business. It's affecting Equifax's business right now because of not keeping up with it. We need to improve our cybersecurity oversight. We need to understand that this is not a game we can play alone. This is a game that we need support for and we need help with. You are never going to get through this if you're trying to go it alone. It's just that simple. I don't care how smart your IT people are. I don't care how smart your cybersecurity guy is. I've been in this business 40 years, and I guarantee you I learn something new every week. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. You need other folks to help you be successful at this. So build those relationships. And don't be afraid to build those relationships with law enforcement either, so that when you do end up in a situation, God forbid, you actually have a good enough relationship with those folks that you can manage that situation effectively, right? And it doesn't become something that ends up being a burden to you. Build and practice incident response plans. Yep.
Just a question for you, number one. It sounds obvious. I know how to build relationships, but with law enforcement, that's a little bit more tricky. So do you have some suggestions on how, if you're not calling them for when you need something, what are you calling them for? How are you engaging?
Great question. All right. So just a little over 3 years ago, the federal government gave $6 billion to DHS and FBI and a few other agencies to literally create outreach programs around cybersecurity across the industries, right? Right now, you can go to DHS, you can go to their website, or you can go to local DHS office, and you can actually request that they come in and run an exercise for your executive team, free, no cost to you at all. And they will come in and give your executives the latest and greatest intelligence. They actually even clear them at the secret level temporarily for the purpose of the exercise to be able to share with them real information about what's going on in the threat environment that, quite frankly, the general public doesn't hear all the time. But they'll run those exercises. They'll provide you resources, and they have resources that they can give you. The Bureau, through its InfraGuard program and through this program, will also do the same thing. The local cyber point for the Bureau office will come in and give your organization briefings. They will come in and participate in your cyber exercises if you invite them. The Bureau actually has taken a very proactive approach to not being typical law enforcement when it comes to cybersecurity, and which I think was very smart on their part, because when they first started this many years ago, everybody wouldn't talk to them. Because what did they do? They came in, and what was the first thing law enforcement did when they came in? They took all your computers. They literally did. They would literally take the computers and leave the jack in the wall, right?
So are you referring to the NCATS program, the NCATS, where they will assist with your cybersecurity exercises? And
yep.
So we have reached out to them for that, and also we were able to reach out to our FBI field office, and they did come in, and it's just a simple introduction of this is who we are, this is what we do, and they provided us some general intelligence at the time and who to talk to and when things happen. So the NCATS, I don't remember the acronym off the top of my head, but it was through, and then we subscribed to InfraGuard as well as a very, very valuable threat intel resource.
Yeah, and you can also become a member of the National Health ISAC. So the point is that it is very easy to coordinate with these folks today. It's also, they also have dollars associated with providing you with resources and support. And it's very useful for you to get to know them ahead of time so that your local FBI agent knows you, right? He probably is only going to see you once a year. Maybe he comes in and gives you a current threat brief. But hey, he comes in once a year and gives you a current threat brief and gets to know you a little bit. Then when something happens, he shows up, he's actually a little bit familiar with you. It's much far better than him walking in cold, right? He also will share with you the things that they need in an investigation, which also will help you prepare for that. So in other words, he will tell you, if there is an incident, you call us in. Here's the things that we're going to be wanting to see or wanting to ask for, or things that we're going to need. Now you have time ahead of time to think about, how am I going to give that to him without disrupting my operation, right? The problem in most cases is that people don't think through this process ahead of time, and when it happens, it becomes incredibly disruptive, right? But the Bureau and DHS in particular have done a great job of trying not to let that happen. And last but not least, become and stay educated about cybersecurity issues. And again, joining InfraGuard, joining the National Health ISAC, joining these sources that provide information. Granted, a lot of that information is fairly general, but it's still information that you can share with your executive team. It's information you can share with your operators and other folks in the business. And it just helps them generally stay up to date on what's going on out there. Understand and approach cybersecurity as an enterprise-wide risk management issue, not as an IT issue. Quit putting this burden on the IT guys, because quite frankly, in most cases, they're not the problem. They're not the problem. It's the operator. It's the person who clicks on the phishing email. It's something else going on in the environment, right? From time to time, they are the problem. When they don't patch frequently enough, when they don't configure something properly, when they let a vendor install something in the environment and don't bother to check what they've done, that is their problem, no doubt about it. But this is an organizational issue, and we need to treat it that way. Understand the legal implications and cyber risks as they relate to the organization's specific circumstances, and in particular, with your vendors. With your vendors. For instance, did you know that Equifax and a couple of the other organizations of that sort have actually sponsored legislation to give them access to PHI, but to relieve them of the responsibilities of HIPAA? It's actually in the legislation. They want to be able to collect PHI as part of their service that they're providing to you, and I have no idea what that has to do with credit, but somehow they've made a connection. And yet in that same piece of legislation, it suggests that they should not have the burden of having to protect that data like the healthcare providers or the patients that information is going to come from. Understand who you're doing business with. Understand what their responsibilities are. Understand when you are at risk with respect to a relationship. Have adequate access to cybersecurity expertise and give cyber risk management regular and adequate time at board meetings and agendas. You're the IT guy, you're the security guy? Okay. Do you actually talk to the board? Okay. Are you on any of the board's committees?
In our corporate compliance committees, those are committees of the board.
Okay. So yes. Good. You know, that needs to happen. And it needs to happen everywhere. We need to have somebody on that board or somebody reporting to that board that can actually articulate what these issues are. What I have found is that in those instances where I have been invited to talk to a board or talk to an executive team, oftentimes the IT organization benefits almost immediately after that with respect to dollars for certain things that they have not been able to get themselves. The problem I have with that is twofold. The first one is that I'm probably not saying anything that they haven't already said. I hate to say it, but often sometimes you're trapped by this. The outside person saying it sometimes is louder than the inside person saying it. But the other thing is that if they made the decision that quickly, then somebody already knew that it was an issue anyway, or that it and they just hadn't bothered to deal with it yet. But unfortunately, a lot of it comes down to being able to translate what we do on the security side, the cyber side, into business speak. We've got to start talking the language of the business, not the language of security, right? And that's why I say translating what we're doing on patch management to the P&L is a perfect example of making it relevant to them. If you don't mind your balance sheet, what happens to your business, right? Something suffers. If you don't mind your patching, what happens? Your business is going to suffer sooner or later. Set the expectation that management will establish risk management framework with adequate staffing and budget. Now, I'm a big proponent for a lot of reasons of the NIST cybersecurity framework, and it's the one that I've been using in this industry for 17 years. It's the only one that I recommend, quite frankly. And the reason for that is because we got an organization that we pay billions of dollars a year to do nothing but keep it up to date for us. Nobody else, no commercial product is ever going to be as accurate or as up to date or as broad in its scope as what NIST can provide. Because that's what those people do day in and day out, every day when they come to work. And they're some of the brightest scientists that I've ever met in technology working in that building. Okay? You don't need to pay for other frameworks. You don't need to go shop for industrial-based frameworks. That framework is free to everybody. And we're actually in the process now of building tools to make it even easier to implement that framework. So I think, you know, one of the things I would recommend to you, if you haven't adopted NIST, think about it strongly. Make sure that we're discussing security on a regular basis. It's really interesting because almost every day there's something to talk about. This is not like a boring topic where you have to really, you know, sit down in a room and go, what are we going to talk about today? Equifax or somebody will always give you something to talk about. They're wonderful at it. Okay? Keep in mind that all those third-party relationships are just a link in our chain. Don't let them be the weak link. And I'm going to stop there and let you guys ask questions. Sir?
I've trained them.
On your standards slide,
which slide?
Standards slide where you're advocating use of NIST.
Yep.
Besides the free part and the fact that they have that's their full-time job, how do you compare that with HITRUST?
Easy. HITRUST is nothing but a late derivative of NIST. Does anybody understand where HITRUST came from? I was one of the original people when this thing first started, way back when, who was asked to look at it, and I did. And I said, for the life of me, I don't get it. There's nothing here that doesn't exist already in NIST, ISO, PCI, whatever, that you have access to, right? The other thing that worries me with the HITRUST model that some people have ascribed to is that HITRUST model does not provide you with any safety net. And everybody needs to understand that. There is no safety net, no matter what framework you decide to implement. Period. I don't care what somebody hands you in the form of a certification. The federal government does not recognize anybody's certification when it comes to incidents. This came up in this year's OCR meeting. I guess it happened a few weeks ago. there was a huge backlash from a lot of the government reps that were there from OCR and from NIST, et cetera, that said, be careful what you do with a lot of these commercial variant certification programs. Don't put your trust in those and think that because you are high trust certified or PCI certified or whatever, that we are not going to come investigate you if there's an incident, and that we are not going to hold you accountable for everything that you should have done. Just that simple. It does not provide any safety net whatsoever. The other thing is, you got to be really careful with respect to what goes into these things, because a lot of times they don't have all of the requirements in there that the NIST or the government may be looking for. And so when somebody makes a judgment call with respect to an industry, what an industry needs, that doesn't assume that the government agrees with that judgment call.
Have you had any experience where OCR or some of these regulators, when they're auditing you, if you followed NIST as compared to HITRUST or any other standard, you'll get a little bit more preferable treatment?
So we work very closely with OCR, and actually we've been a monitor twice now for them, for folks who have ended up in a resolution agreement situation, and we've actually been on the front end of them. Sometimes they will bring us in to work with an organization in lieu of a resolution agreement. So we know exactly what they're looking for, and they are absolutely following the NIST cybersecurity framework with respect to their investigations and their audits. If you've seen their OCR audit protocol, that is what they're using now for all of their complaint resolutions and for all of their investigations. So it is literally, in their mind, and think of it this way. This is a federal organization that is enforcing a piece of federal legislation. They can't use a commercial standard to do that, because that commercial standard has no standing in the federal government or in the federal courts. So if the federal government, in this case OCR, were to use, let's say they were to use ISO as an example, as a basis for a conclusion around an investigation, it would get thrown out, because it's not recognized by our government as a regulatory standard. So they're going to use, and they do use the NIST standards for everything they do, right? Now, does it provide preferential treatment? It absolutely does. I can tell you from experiences where both providers as well as other folks have told us that they have had audits, they've had investigations, they've been involved in situations that when they were able to demonstrate that they were following the NIST guidelines, that it went so much better. And in many cases, they weren't expected to be perfect. That's one thing. The other thing, too, that's a fallacy. The government does not expect you to be perfect. They expect that in your environment at any given time, there is going to be X amount of risk all the time. What they're looking for is what does your program look like? How proactive is your program? How active are you at managing the things that you find when you do your risk assessments, et cetera? Are you actually actively going out and remediating those things, or have a plan to remediate those things? And is it based on a recognizable standard? Okay, you had a question.
So two questions, actually. The first question is just about blockchain. Maybe we can offline a discussion on that. I've had a couple of people approach and ask if we looked into the technology. I have a little bit, but I don't know that it's a magic bullet for application of security of records. So if we could offline or even have a bigger discussion, if anyone's interested, about blockchain itself. The second comment is, you know, if you do apply HITRUST, and I'm not going to debate, you know, that, I mean, to respect your opinion very much, it's what you're doing it for. I would agree that you can't use HITRUST as your magic bullet. Oh, we're safe because we're certified. But what it does is it helps you conglomerate between PCI and ISO and different regs that you have to comply with as a single source. And NIST absolutely does the same thing.
Right.
But it's also a scaling perspective to the size and scope of your enterprise. And you have to be willing to accept that risk and understand what you're saying. But it also allows you, if you're going to be a service provider, to say, this is a certification that is an industry-recognized certification, though it will not help you in defense of, like, with the federal government. So it's just understanding what you're applying and how to use it and assuring that you can still comply with those regs as appropriate. So, and then that's just my comments on that.
Yeah.
So,
well, the other thing too, think of it this way. What I tell organizations is if you're going to embrace the high trust model and or pay for that tool, then you need to think of it that way. It's a tool. And you decide the framework that you model in that tool. You don't let somebody else decide it for you. You don't necessarily accept what they tell you. You decide what you want to model in that. The interesting thing is that tool, just like every other tool out there that models all these different frameworks, all do the same thing. They all do the same thing. And there are multiple tools out there that do the aggregation process, and there are multiple organizations out there that can help you do that if you don't have a tool that does that. But right now, NIST, recognizing that this debate has gotten to the point that it has, is actually creating those additional tools to help organizations in healthcare do that. And the difference is that when you use the NIST model, eventually you will be using a set of standards and a framework that the government has agreed is the right standard for healthcare. Meaning there is nothing that OCR can deviate from when they come to look at it, when they're looking at that, right? Because they're part of that organization. NIST is part of HHS, right? So they have people in there and a dedicated team working on this. There's also a task force now that is working on this as well, because everybody understands that one of the problems that NIST had with respect to its standards is scalability in terms of people being able to use them. If you're not familiar with them, they can be fairly daunting, right? But if you just take the cybersecurity framework in and of itself, then it's not that daunting at all. It's no more daunting than any other standard that's out there. But the difference is that every other standard that exists gets its information from NIST, whether it's HITRUST, whether it's ISO, whether it's PCI, etc. They're not creating anything. All they're doing is taking what those folks have created and repackaging it and then selling it. That's what it amounts to. And the only issue that I have with this is when the marketing message that you get a certification, you are somehow safe. And we all know that they give that message out. And that is a very, very dangerous message. Because it's just not accurate at all. And it almost came to an argument on the floor in the NIST, in the OCR conference a few weeks ago because of that very issue.
There's no such thing as safe.
There's no such thing as safe, that's right. Just like there's no such thing as secure.
Question for you about one thing I will say, though, is that I always ensure my organizations are NIST aligned. I feel as strongly as you do about it, but that's not what my clients are asking me to be in compliance with. They want HITRUST. They don't want NIST. So it would be really helpful as if people would align NIST and HITRUST better so I can just auto-run a report. And I know people, they're working on that if they haven't already. So what can, you know, so the messaging
and they,
is not
and
reaching
actually,
people.
And actually, HITRUST does have representatives on the work group that is working on this issue. But the point is that the government is never going to recognize any one a vendor, period. Not going to do it. So I don't care whether it's HITRUST, I don't care whether it's Clearwater Consulting that has a NIST tool out there, whether it's Comply Assistant who has a tool out there. I don't care whose tool it is. The federal government cannot endorse a vendor's certification.
So there is, I think that the fundamental discussion here is you can't use HITRUST or any cert as your, okay, we're good. It is, like you said, a tool, risk assessment tool.
Yeah.
And
right.
To come closer, you know, HITRUST recently, so they're V9, and they do have a NIST cybersecurity mapping, so you can do a NIST assessment.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's essentially, it all boils back to NIST. So using HITRUST as that, you know, because the industry calls for it is one thing, but that's a business decision, and it's also a tool that allows us to assess risk. But when it comes down, there's a difference between the application of what the government is saying and then what we do within the business community. As long as we understand that all roads lead back to Rome, you'll be in better shape.
So keep in mind that there's also, you know, this is one of the, I won't mention the name, but one of the big insurance companies actually went out and bought 4,000 high trust licenses to literally provide them to their vendors so that they would fill out the questionnaires and submit the data. The vendors refused to do it. So now that particular insurance company has, even though they still use HITRUST, no longer uses it for their vendors. They'll accept any assessment that is based on the NIST CSF. You know, we do assessments for vendors as well. We always use the NIST CSF. Not one of ours has ever had an issue. Even if you have a HITRUST requirement, all you do is you take whatever risk assessment you have, the results of that risk assessment, and port it into the self-assessment questionnaire or the tool, and report your results, and you take care of your compliance issue with the vendor. The reason a lot of those companies want the vendors to do that is because it makes it easier for them to manage the data. Doesn't make it more secure, doesn't make it more accurate, doesn't make it more effective, doesn't help the situation at all, except it gives them a piece of paper that you've submitted that says that you either have or haven't done certain things, which then directly relates to your liability and your indemnification. That's really what it comes down to. It's a legal discussion. It is not a security discussion. And that's the problem that I have with it. I mean, I've been doing this for a very, very long time. You can show me any framework out there. You can show me any organization that's adopted any framework, and I am not going to believe that they're secure until I go look at how they've implemented their program. Because you can do a high trust evaluation this year, not do anything else the rest of the year, and you are not secure. That audit is a point in time assessment of your program. And it's only as accurate as your answers are honest. And if it is a self-assessment, being the old man that I am less likely to trust it. One of the things that, for instance, the banking industry and the federal government, we are not allowed to assess ourselves, no matter how good you are. Sure.
I have a question probably both for you and Meg. So on slide page 15, there is a topic, improve cybersecurity oversight. The step three, can you on my extent kind of maybe create a list for this group, or at least I need it, to show us what are those resources available to help us become and stay educated on cybersecurity trend? The last one, I think Mike mentioned a couple of resources we can be.
Sure, we can. Yeah, we can absolutely do that.
Yeah. And then the first one, maybe because I'm new to healthcare, there are a couple of federal government or agent name you mentioned, like a local FBI, a local DHS, and we can probably explore what resource they have available for us to run exercise. I would appreciate those information too.
So yeah. there is a cyber point for the state of Texas for the FBI, and I don't know which office that person is in here in the state of Texas, but generally the way the FBI operates based on their regions, they'll have a cyber point at each one of their regions, and then they'll have a cyber point at each one of their large offices. They usually don't have them at the smaller offices, but they'll have them at the larger offices, and those individuals, their whole existence is wrapped around these kinds of investigations. All you have to do is go to the FBI website and go and plug in cybersecurity, and you'll go right to all their information. And there's information numbers that you can call there, and they can tell you exactly based on where you live or where you're located, who your cyber point is, what his name is or her name is, and how to get in touch with them. The Department of Homeland Security is the same way. Well, it's a little bit different with the Department of Homeland Security. They're not quite as dispersed as the FBI is, but they do have local presences as well. You also have, believe it or not, the Treasury Department with respect to the Secret Service. A lot of people don't realize that the Secret Service has anything to do with cybersecurity, but they actually do. But it's generally more on the financial side. But the best two, at least initially, and the two that have the money for outreach activities are the Bureau and the Department of Homeland Security. But even your local law enforcement, like the state of Texas DPS, there's a cyber point in Austin for DPS. And there are also cyber points at certain DPS offices, larger DPS offices, like, for instance, in Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Austin, et cetera. And those folks, they have cyber units. And so those folks are also available to you. And that's important to understand, because there are certain things that you need to, for instance, if you have a physician or a staff member who is the victim of tax fraud, for instance, right? In order for that whole process to get started, for the federal government to respond to that incident, you first have to report it to the local police. Makes no sense whatsoever, because tax is a federal issue and it's your federal tax ID. But you have to report that first to the local police department. They have to establish a case. They have to open a case and give it a case number. That case number then is communicated to the IRS. And at that point, the IRS investigative organization opens the investigation and provides protection for that individual in terms of going forward and handling their case. But if you don't know what those processes are, you know, you can find yourself wasting a lot of time instead of being really helpful when people come to you and needing that kind of assistance. This is why it's so important to develop these resources ahead of time and to understand what they can provide to you, as well as to understand what their processes are with respect to if you need their assistance. So the Bureau will actually come out and give you a very, very nice checklist that says, when there's an issue that you report to us, here are the things that we're going to ask for when we come on site. That you can give that direct to your IT organization, who is going to have the bulk of those items to have to produce. But some of them are not. But the point is that you can use that to help enhance your own incident response processes at your organization. So it's all there. It's all, and if you want afterwards, Melody, take a note. I can have one of the guys send you a list, and then you can disseminate it. But yeah, you should know who those resources are. You should know that the National Health ISAC is connected to what's called the NCCIC, which is the back door into the government's information around cyber information, and they produce alerts and information. InfraGuard, which is an FBI program, provides alerts and information. I think even the Department of Homeland Security has certain listservs that you can get on to get information. So all this information is there. It's just yours for somebody to go grab.
Thank you.
One of the things that we do at Cox Health Plans is we have a honeypot. Do you guys have a honeypot pot out there?
Do you have a virtual one or a real one?
We have a real one.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love it. No, it's like the end of the month IT party for the nerds, for us, you know?
So you're not talking about the honeypot that he and I are thinking about. Okay.
No. I've got a server out there, loosely configured, loose security on it, got some URLs. It is unbelievable how much that server is hit and what they do to that server. And we literally, at the end of the month, we wipe it, we start it back up. We have URLs out there that looks like our web page, and we
put
some out there.
It's not connected to your network.
Absolutely
though.
Not. Okay. No. I am a CIO. I have earned my degrees, okay?
Before you go on any further, does everybody in this room know what a honeypot is? So a honeypot is a fake system that is put out there to attract the bad guys, hopefully, so that they hit there first and you discover it before they actually hit your network, or so that they actually get their attacks become deflected because they hit that thinking that it's you and it's not really you.
We learn so much from it. We know where they're coming from. Now, go over here on our production server and block Russia or whoever. It's a learning tool for us. But No, it is. It's not even related to us at all. Not that that won't stop them to find us. But it's more of a learning tool for us. But we've had I'm serious, like a URL, they will redirect it to a porn site. It's like, oh, that was interesting. Who would have thought that? So there's that kind of thing, but then there's real damage that they do to it, literal hardware damage to it, like hit my motherboard so hard I've just burned up a motherboard again.
Yeah,
it's amazing what they're doing. But yeah, we love our honeypot. It's It really is. We order pizza and we celebrate our honey pot.
So honey pots are a deceptive security measure. We've had them for at least 40 years that I know of. We used to deploy them all the time, and we still do in the federal government. Today, you actually can deploy either a virtual or a real honeypot.
Right.
It is far better for commercial entities who don't have dedicated staffs to manage those things, because honeypots can also be flipped over and used against you. So depending on the sophistication of the attacker. So it is far better to use a virtual honeypot today than it is to use a real one, unless you have a dedicated staff that's managing that. The virtual ones are also nice because most of the organizations that produce the virtual honeypots now have the ability to redirect the information that's hitting those virtual presences back to other systems that can record and alert, so that whoever is monitoring your network can actually see that in real time and actually shut those things down at the network and do those kinds of things. But honeypots are not something that I recommend. It's normally not something that I talk about to non-technical groups. It's not something I recommend to people to play with, but you obviously are having fun with it.
Oh, yeah, we enjoy it.
But it is
a learning tool. I mean, the ultimate goal is that it's a learning tool. We just are amazed by what they do.
You can do that. You can take a computer. You can just go down and buy a cheap laptop and then connect it to a Wi-Fi network and then watch what happens to it.
Agreed.
Right? Within minutes, you'll have scores of probes to that device.
Right.
I mean, that's just the nature of our environment today.
I agree.
But those are out there. If you're interested in that, your IT group can look up that stuff.
Just a final question. And we're really at this state of critical mass when it comes to cyber attacks, cyber espionage. At what point do we as an organization, because we're already halfway considerate, we have a project called Project Romulan, and Star Trek fans will get it. What point do we disconnect?
You know, this is why I said, coming back to that ransomware discussion about backing up data, you know, we've literally gone full circle in terms of what we need to do there. Sometimes what we find ultimately is that the simplest things we do are the most effective things we do. All this complexity, all this connectivity, all this sharing, et cetera, it does absolutely escalate the risk. There's no doubt about it. It comes with risk. And the problem is that the reason you're where you are today is that in most organizations, we have embraced the change, and we have embraced the all of these different capabilities, but we haven't brought security along with it. And so now the reason we are where we are today is because we are literally probably two decades behind where we need to be with security today. Even our technology. I mean, we've just in the last couple of years had the emergence of advanced malware detection capabilities, because it finally got to the point where we realized that antivirus was just laughing at it as it went by. Right? We now have next generation firewalls, because we realized all of a sudden that the old firewalls were again not effective. The problem, though, is that we have now taken our previous, you know, we used to think of a network in the confines of a space, right? And now it's not that anymore. It is so dispersed that there is no, you almost can't draw a line around it. It's just amorphous, right? There's holes everywhere. And in fact, if the technologists and the big data folks have their way, We are a few years away in their minds of no network at all. Literally having all of our data in the cloud, having all of our systems supported somewhere else, and having users with an end user device. No more servers in the data center, no more workstations on the on the desktop. Literally, everybody has some device that they use, and everything is somewhere else. And the problem with that, from a security perspective, is that that means now that I have to try to figure out how to protect it, everywhere else, and I have to rely on those everywhere else's to do that. And this is another place where the vendors have not kept up as well, because the vendors have wanted the benefit of taking that stuff from you and providing those services to you for revenue recognition purposes, but they haven't wanted to spend the money to protect it. Take the medical device issue we have right now, right? We still have 99% of our medical devices that are insecure. We are now having the FDA recall devices for the first time. They've recalled two now. You know, there's a bunch more that they could recall if they would. But even knowing all of the issues associated with those devices, we still don't have the industry, the manufacturers of those devices, saying we're going to fix the problem, because it's not cost effective for them to fix it. It is cheaper, far cheaper for them to use software that is free, or code that is free, and to not have to have all the testing that's associated with security testing around code to be able to rush a product to market so that they can sell it, than it is to actually design it, build it properly so that it's maintainable and securable. And that's where we're at.
Mac, thank you. Great discussion, great presentation. Really appreciate your coming in.
Thank you.